Hey, did I get your attention? How's everybody doing out there? You look good.
Yeah.
This next bio I'm about to read for you, we're going to be here all day. I'm just kidding. All right. Mike Pell is a leading design for the Microsoft Garage, an innovation accelerator turning people's wild ideas into reality worldwide. Bold, insightful, and uncompromising, Mike is recognized as a thought leader in the field of visualization and an expert in the radical simplification of experiences. Good job. Just kidding. His career in high tech has covered the gamut from intrepid entrepreneur to venture-backed startup veteran to corporate man from Adobe and Microsoft over the last three decades. Mike thrives on the chaotic and ever-changing nature of hack culture within the garage and the continuous opportunities it presents to learn by doing. Please welcome the amazing Mike Pell.
Thank you. That was great. Thank you. Thank you very much. I am speechless. Thank you all for being here. First of all, before I got here, this is really great. When I'm in your seat and I go to a conference and the speaker asks a question, I hate raising my hand. I can't stand it. But can you do me a favor? Has anybody actually read the book? Okay, good. So nobody's read the book. Or you don't want to raise your hand. That's awesome. I like both. So I do a lot of work in design. I'm also a coder. I've done a lot of different projects over the years, but most recently I've been spending a lot of time with what we call mixed reality. And so I just thought I would share with you what I've learned and hopefully ask you some questions about what you're working on and what you hope comes out of all this. Fair enough? It's like, this is gonna be like super casual, so even if I'm in the middle of talking, just like raise your hand, blurt it out, I don't care. Okay, so when I asked Henry, who set up this talk for me, what do you guys wanna hear? Like, what does the audience usually wanna hear? And he said, you know, people really want to hear what's not in the book. I mean, you can buy the book, you can, you know, figure out all that stuff, but I'd rather tell you what I didn't put in there and why. So this is me at work. I do work at Microsoft. Microsoft Garage is sort of our experimental outlet at Microsoft. We have all kinds of interesting projects that we release into the world to see if anybody cares, do people like them, are they useful experiments. And in that, I get to experiment. I get to design rooms. This is our reality room. So we sort of have like one of everything in these reality rooms. And so I get to experiment and figure out like what's possible with holograms, what's possible with virtual reality, augmented reality. And I assume because you're here, all of you know what all this stuff is. I'm going to skip over most of that. Fair enough? I wrote this book about what I learned as a designer and what I felt like I wanted to share. There's lots of books about the technical part of programming for VR and like lots of articles on Medium. You can find all that stuff. Not so much on the design side. There's some great ones, you know, if you go to Medium, really, really good ones. But for me, I just wanted to share these things that I thought were kind of non-intuitive, things that you wouldn't think were really true if you were designing for this space. The first thing that I thought about, I walked into a hotel lobby one night, and it struck me that this is a beautiful space, but it was really empty and kind of cold, even though it was like, you know, this beautiful color and lighting. And I said, wow, why couldn't you just imagine filling that space with some kind of like maybe a DJ from Brooklyn? And, you know, as people are walking through the lobby, they could just sort of see this, you know, this like fire that's sort of dancing and this like weird, you know, like light monster that's actually, you know, moving to the music. Why can't we have that in hotels that are just so boring? And that is what led me to wanting to write about envisioning, which is essentially that, right? It's using your imagination, using techniques to try to go fast, to try to get your idea in some form that you can share with somebody else. Doesn't really matter what form. It could be telling a story. It could be a full-blown, you know, mixed reality, virtual reality experience. It could be a drawing. But you have to put things in a form that you can have a discussion. You can try them out. So if you have to go, because I know there's a million cool things to do here, this is the most important thing in the entire book. And it may be for all of what we do in high-tech design. It is never, ever, ever about the technology. It's always about the people. And I think you'll find that over and over again to be true. You know, we sort of get enamored with, we invented something cool, let's figure out what to do with it. It should never be that way, right? It's like, what are people trying to do? What are they thinking? How are they feeling? What can we do to help them? And then secondly, these like VR headsets, you look ridiculous when you put on VR headsets. I'm sorry, like nobody wants to talk about that. It's crazy. So for people who are old enough to realize, like this is one of the first commercial like cell phones, right? Doesn't that look kind of dumb? Like what would you think if you were walking down the street and you saw somebody talking on a phone like that. Okay, that's what you look like when you have a VR headset on right now. Okay, so just remember that. Okay, so lots of talk about reality. Anybody who's been in this space, like, you know, studying what's going on with AR, VR, MR, mixed reality, you know that it's super messy, super confusing, because as technologists, we're like really into terminology and no, it can't be that if it's this. And for me, look, there's physical reality, right, where we are today. There's augmented reality. For me, I'm going to get a very narrow definition. If you pull out your phone or a tablet and you look through it to see something that's not there, see some digital content, like sort of through the looking glass, that's what I consider augmented reality. And as you can argue with me, it's like, oh, we have headsets, we have like other ways to do that. Simple definition. Mixed reality is when you're in a physical space, and usually by wearing some kind of optics, you see something that's not there. So you're not looking through something, you're actually seeing it. It could be right next to you. It could be as big as this room. So for me, that's my definition of mixed reality. That's what I wrote the book about. Because that's, of all the things, that's most interesting to me. Stay in the real world and add things to it. Virtual reality, completely, you know, teleported somewhere else. Completely encased in digital. That's great. It's really fun. And then we get to artificial. Right? So when you add artificial intelligence, machine learning to any of these things, it's often called artificial reality. Like, clear as mud, right? I thought so. For me personally, I love mixed reality because, you know, as much as I have you know, good imagination, I like sci-fi, I like to see what we can do with what we have in this world, right? I love going to VR and going places I've never seen, but my design sense is about here. You see this sort of manifested as, like, I don't know why we always use dinosaurs. Dinosaurs are like the weird joke for this whole space. It's like, you know, people always use an example of a dinosaur that's not there. This is a game that Microsoft put out for the HoloLens, right, which is a self-contained holographic computer headset that you wear for mixed reality. In this game, it's super creepy. There's this hologram that walks out and sits down on your couch or a chair next to you, and you freak out when that happens for the first time because you do not expect something digital can understand what's going on in your living room and just come and sit on your couch. It's pretty cool, though. It's a pretty great experience for mixed reality. You can imagine this extending into the office, right, super easily. And this is sort of like, I have a real interest in this and like productivity. Like, what can we do with this? I don't want to make 3D bar charts. I don't want to make, you know, stupid things. But just imagine being able to do something a little bit better than we can now through the special optics, through mixed reality. And for me, as a designer, it's like, all if you're designers, you're basically professional storytellers. It's fair to say. Okay, and you can say, you know, storytelling comes in so many different forms, and we sort of use whatever we have at our means. I think mixed reality is going to become one of the dominant forms of storytelling of many types for business, for entertainment, for education. And so I'm hoping to sort of just share with you a few things that you might think about when you're doing your own storytelling, whether it's for like a sales presentation, talking to your kids, talking to people you work with. It's all like, you know, all those narratives that you know how to put together. Mixed reality is, I think, going to help you. And I would like to sort of share what I learned about putting those narratives together. Does anybody know who that is? Alex Kipman from Microsoft. He did a TED Talk a few years ago that you can find online pretty easily, where he took the HoloLens, right? He's wearing this visor, right? Self-contained holographic computer, and he's on stage. And he's looking at this incredibly colorful and interesting space around him. The audience sees Alex sort of squatting down with an empty stage, right? He sees all these amazing things. Everyone else is confused unless they're looking at a screen where they're doing digital compositing. And the reason for that is that people can only see holograms with special optics today. You know, I'm sure projection technology will come along, people will be able to do more things, but just imagine, like this is where I'm going to ask you to use your imagination. Just imagine, we go so fast in technology. How long will it be until you can be in a room like this and have me talking about holograms and mixed reality and actually be able to see it through some means? Probably not that long. Am I a hologram? Did you just ask if I'm a hologram? No. So for envisioning, so my definition of envisioning is just using any means you can to get something tangible enough to show someone else. Right? Envisioning is the act of thinking about what could be and making that real enough to share with other people. For me, just like, you know, conferences like this, you're in your hotel, you're walking around, you see these like empty seats. I thought to myself, you know, at a conference like this, how come it can't show me the next available session, how long it's going to take me to get there, and which one I should really, you know, look at without having to like look at my phone or dig through some paper? And so that's sort of what I thought about. You know, why can't I just walk up to the surface and just see where I should go next? Right? Seems pretty easy. When you're, yeah, how many conference spaces that you know of are just completely wasted because, you know, they don't look like people should be sitting there talking about business? This is like a super nice one. When I saw that, I started to think, wow, wouldn't it be great if I could sort of share what was going on with my colleagues? You know, sort of use the surfaces to put whatever product we're working on, be able to review our schedules, be able to like look at what's happening with production costs. We can do this today, but it's all trapped behind the glass, right? It's all trapped within the black mirror, right? And that's not satisfying. I don't think anybody enjoys that very much. Same thing with this. This is a lunch area in Korea, and I was walking by going, wow, how come you can't see when people are at lunch today, if they're reading a book, you can see they're reading a book. If they're watching something on their laptop, you can see they're watching something on their laptop. So this sort of brings up, so envisioning for me is also about the possibilities. So what if you could actually see what other people were seeing when they're inside their VR headsets or mixed reality optics? So I don't think it's going to be very long until, as storytellers, we can start to share our visions with other people walking by. Like, you can choose to keep it private. You can choose to not share it. But what if you could? What would you do with that? Right? What would you, well, you know, if you could just put anything you wanted on this chair and everybody could see it, it was digital, you could interact with it, how would you use that? So that's what I like to think about with envisioning. Same thing with data. People do these really interesting things with data. They're like, oh, I'm going to build the coolest 3D pie chart ever in VR. It's going to be awesome. It's going to be better than any pie chart that's been ever created. They never are. It's stupid to do that. Please don't do that. Please, please don't do that. I actually work with data quite a bit. It's not going to work out well. What is going to work out well, if you take your information and your data and you figure out how to bring it to life in room scale, meaning use all the available space you have to sort of to depict something in particular. In this particular case, in a server farm, inside this data center, you can imagine being able to see what's inside the server racks, right? Whether it's capacity or errors or like transfer rates. But once you actually see data at room scale, total game changer. You can only do that by experimenting, right? By envisioning, by trying things. So that was pretty fun. So really quick, what do you see here? What's that? Sorry, I'm... launch pads. I love that. I love that. Anybody know where this is? It's a MoMA, right? Yeah, it's like the lobby in MoMA. So I was walking around. I was like, wow. See, I'm like one of those, I guess I'm weird. I see things where they don't exist. When I see an empty space, my mind immediately wants to fill it with something. And usually it's with holograms. So I'll start like looking at that going, wow, that's just screaming to be filled with something fun, right? Like you're walking around a museum, like why can't there be something really great there? And of course, what is actually there is a giant dinosaur, right? Every time there's gotta be a dinosaur. Okay, but what's really interesting in this is that there's a family, right? So, you know, of course, like New York's very busy, people are looking at the museum, they're walking around. So you have a family with like young kids, like the kids looking at the dinosaur that's out there on the patio. And in this particular drawing style, it's like sketching style I'm using, which is from architecture for the most part. The silhouettes that are black are people that are actually there. This is just my shorthand that I use. And the people that are blue, the silhouettes that are blue, are not there. So these people that are in this lobby are actually interacting with like grandpa over here. But he's at home, right? But he can actually share this experience. So I think it's really fun to think about, because the technology will support this. Like, we never have to worry about the tech not being good enough to support these scenarios. What we have to worry about is us not having the great ideas to try to push ourselves forward to get here fast enough. That's where envisioning comes in. That's why I wrote the book. So I'm just going to go through really quick. By the way, after this talk, if you don't have to, but if you wanted to, I'm going to be signing books down the hallway. You can actually read this or like do whatever you want. I'm just going to go through it really quick. I understand a lot of you haven't read the book, so I'm going to try to summarize the chapter super quick, right? We can get to questions. So who knows who Tony Parisi is? Anybody? Tony's an old buddy of mine. Tony was one of the original creators of something called VRML along with Mark Pesce. So back in the mid-90s, so 3D, this like VR, AR, like this whole thing, it's like a sine wave. Like it shows up and it dies out, and it shows up and it dies out. And this has been going on for decades and decades. So Tony and I were sort of in this VRML, virtual reality markup language scene, and we were trying to get 3D to work inside of a web browser in the 90s. It's like a really dumb idea, but we had just read Snow Crash and it was really great. Like we were gonna do all these cool things. And so when I wanted to write this book, I thought, who would be the right person? Like who's been through this long enough to know the power of envisioning, to know the power of actually dreaming? And Tony turned out to be one of the best people, but I had to make a giant billboard to get him to write the foreword. I wish I didn't have to do that. So the first chapter is, what's so special about holograms, right? Holograms in I would say principle, if you're super technical about it, holograms are light, right? They're things that are generated from, you can look at them through special optics, you can look at them by projecting things onto glass. But there's something that happens from a design standpoint with a hologram. And from a design standpoint, when you view a hologram for the first time, it's immediately emotional. I'm not a psychologist. I couldn't explain this. I started to ask people, like, why do holograms have that reaction? Like why do people just fall in love with them? Like, why are they mesmerized the very first time they see them? And I don't think that we really know exactly, but I got a pretty good definition that when you look at something like this, your brain is imprinting the memory with emotion. So some things are imprinted with no real emotion, but holograms, for some reason, they really make a deep connection with people. So just imagine the kinds of stories that you could have, like, you know, with your child, or just imagine, like, you know, I mean, kids have such great imaginations. What if they could control the narrative? What if they could actually, on demand, generate their own stories, you know, just like this, where they're seeing something digital and be able to do that themselves? Who knows, right? Who knows what could happen? So what I found, my observation, is that for whatever reason that I can't explain, holograms are super emotionally connected to people. And as a designer, couldn't ask for anything better, right? We're all sort of like searching for that. Like, how do we make, like, that's the first thing that they teach you. How do you make a connection with people with your design? Turns out holograms do that without you even trying. As you know, there's all kinds of different people. They have all kinds of different reactions. This is not like across the board. Every single person in the world loves holograms. Every once in a while, you get people who are like sort of fearing the technology. They're not so happy with these. And they're wondering, like, why is technology going this way? Why is this happening? Why can't we just leave things the way that we are? And that leads to confusion, right? And it's like people do things just because they can. Right? We use technology just because we can make giant, you know, 3D bar charts that are as big as this room. It's like, is that connecting with somebody? No. Is it actually a better way to do it? No. So people are confused by that use of technology. They're fearful sometimes, right? You know, sometimes you score and you're like, wow, like that's what I was going for, right? But mostly we're just trying to get people to a place where they actually appreciate it. So holograms are different. So designing for this world, right, where things are ephemeral, right? It's like holograms are made out of light. When they're rendered well, they look real. They look solid. But, you know, your brain knows, just like we were talking about magic, right? Like with a magic trick, you know that there's an illusion going on, but yet you want to believe. And that's what we have to get to as designers with holograms. We have to be able to sort of put ourselves in that position where, you know, we're using it as a tool. And so you cannot be a mobile app designer and think that you're going to start designing something holographic and get it right the first time, you know, perfectly. Because it's actually an inverted model, right? The content has been set free. It's not contained inside of the little rectangle, right? It's not on the screen. It's not on your phone. It's not on your Xbox. It's actually out in the world with you. So when you're doing holographic design, you're actually using the world as your stage. Like, you're using the world as part of your UI and experience. That's not something people normally do, right? It's like, that's not how we design things today. Some people do. They have a lot of fun. But for the most part, that's not how things work. So you got to, like, wrap your head around that. And we also know from movies exactly how holograms work. Anybody who's ever seen one of the Iron Man movies or, like, lots of other great science fiction movies know that you can talk to holograms. They're projected into the air. They're super smart, you know, infused with AI. They're, like, colorful. You know, they can do these amazing things. So we've already basically told ourselves what this is going to be like. And when you see this technology in person for real, that's your expectation. That's why it's so hard as a designer to design for holographic, because people already have expectations. Right? Everybody expects, you know, like, this type of experience. So it doesn't mean that we shouldn't try. It just means that there's something that we're sort of up against. So for envisioning, I found that envisioning is not just about, like, it would be ridiculous to think it was just applying to holograms. Envisioning is a very, very old design technique, right? People have been envisioning. I mean, they call it different things: imagining, imagineering, sketching, brainstorming. For me, I think about things like this. So I was reading Ready Player One. It's like sitting out on my deck. It's like reading it on my iPad. And there was a part where I didn't actually get the reference. Like, so, you know, like Ready Player One, there's a lot of pop culture references that are in the book. And there was this one, like, very exciting battle scene. And I actually didn't notice. I just didn't remember what that monster looked like that Iron Man was fighting. And I didn't want to stop reading and, like, oh, look it up on my phone or do something else. I thought, why, like, when I'm reading this book, why can't I just have that playing out for me? Why can't we start making books that way? So I was envisioning that very quickly books and, you know, maybe, I guess you could say movies, like things come out of the movie, but I think for, in particular, books could really be an interesting playground for thinking about better experiences, better narratives. And then you sort of think to yourself, okay, well, envisioning is such an easy thing to do, right? Like, when should we use it? Turns out it's not always at the beginning. You should try to use it throughout your cycle, right? Try to use it throughout the entire time that you're working on a project. Sometimes, you know very well, projects can take a day, a week, a month, other time years. But for me, in the early exploration, this thing on the far left, that's when you're saying, you know what? Anything's possible. Let's envision. Let's imagine the, like, craziest stuff. Don't have to worry about building it. Let's just figure out, like, what's good and what's bad about it. You sort of move down to the vision setting, where within envisioning, you're saying, okay, we're actually going to set a very particular direction so people get inspired, right? They have something to shoot for. And then finally, you know, in later in the project, we sort of have this, the designers come back and, like, throw a monkey wrench in the works. And they're like, hey, I know we're building this, but what if, like, what if it didn't have to work that way? And that's another great use for envisioning. And then finally, when we get back to, like, very, very late in the project, when everybody's sort of sick of what they're working on and they want to be re-inspired, we'd use envisioning again to figure out how can we actually leap ahead? How can we do things a little bit better if we had more time, if we had more money, if we had more resources? So how do you start envisioning? Just like Nike says, just start, right? It's like you don't have to really consider too hard how to start. There's lots of different techniques that I talk about in the book. My favorite, the easiest thing for me to do that I've been doing for quite a while is as I walk around, like, you know how all my sketches I showed you started with empty spaces? I literally walk around and just take pictures of empty spaces and go back and look at my phone after a while and sort of harvest some interesting ones. Because once you have a picture, you can do anything. You can draw on top of it. You can do compositing. You can use it as a basis for, like, 3D models. There's all kinds of things. But, like, what's easier than just taking a picture with your phone, right? And this is something that I talked about earlier, shifting your mindset. You can't go into working with holograms or holographic computing with your, you know, basic mindset that we use for most of our product design. I'm sure there's industrial designers here and people from other types of industries that really don't think like high-tech product designers. High-tech product designers have a very particular rhythm, a very particular way to go about things. So does anybody know what this is? Right, it's like kind of looked familiar, not really. It's like kind of weird. When you're walking down a hall, like, look up sometime. This is like some kind of I don't know, like emergency light system, right? Something like that. It's over a door. It's typically something that would go on in case of an emergency. When I was walking down this hallway, I saw a chameleon. Do you guys see a chameleon? Okay. That's like getting out of your normal mindset, right? That's like looking for things that aren't there. One of the best lessons I ever learned as a designer was that you have to see the world to be a great designer. So that means actually paying attention to details and being able to like let your imagination go. So to try to get yourself into this, you know, like telling great stories and knowing how to use the narratives, you really have to intentionally try. The techniques, so there's lots of ways that you can envision. These are a few that I sort of like myself, and they sort of go from things that are quick and free and easy. Just telling a story, right? One of the best ways to be able to tell a great narrative is just tell somebody. If you can convincingly tell someone a story and they go, wow, I really like that, let's try to figure that out, then you've done a great job. Sketching, as it turns out, is very difficult when you're working with spatial design and things that are three-dimensional, right? Some people can do it, a lot of people can't. And so you have to think about other ways to do that. There's tools that can help you, like our presentation software, like PowerPoint and other, like, you know, Paint 3D, like easy things, actually have 3D built in. And I was gonna show you a few of those really quickly. And then you have like the super difficult to learn, but very impressive and very persuasive, like using actual 3D and using the hardware and then technology itself. So we always talk about, and I'm just sort of like going through the, like very quickly, the chapters in the book to sort of give you an overview of what it's about. Everybody always says, well, what is the biggest breakthrough? Like, what is holographic computing really going to deliver to us? What is it going to do differently than we've ever done before? And so for me, you know, just going back to like looking at things very carefully, this was, I thought, one of the best examples of cupcake technology ever. Like, somebody figured out how to make like full-on fur for this cupcake, right? So people are looking at detail. It turns out that, like, yes, functionality, you know, being able to do something you've never been able to do before is amazing, and like we always sort of lead with that. But it turns out that the detail in the material and the way that it looks, and, you know, for me, I don't know, maybe not you, but for me, these sort of give off a little bit of an emotion, right? It looks like there's something in that cupcake, right? Like maybe it's not sentient, maybe it's not actually going to start talking to you, but maybe it could, right? Who's to say that next time you walk by, you know, the bakery in your, you know, like local grocery store, that the cupcake doesn't start talking to you? You have to let your mind go there, right? If you really want a breakthrough, you cannot do it. You can't do it stepwise, right? You can't take a linear approach to actually breaking through. You have to like leap far ahead to where it's like almost crazy. Like, why would you even say that? Like, Mike, you like, come on, the cupcake's not going to talk to me, right? Or is it? I don't know. We do know that combining holograms, and this is something that Microsoft has done a lot of research in and lots of other companies, but we know that pairing artificial intelligence with holograms, super interesting, right? Because all of a sudden, we use the power of the machine to help us to tell our stories, to get our points across, to be persuasive, to be clear in ways that we can't do just as storytellers without some kind of machine assist. Same thing with machine learning. So once we do start this process of actually dealing with these digital things, over time, the system is learning and we're figuring out how to be better at all this. Sensors in the Internet of Things, you know, just imagine being able to infuse holographic diagrams and readouts and instructions on simple things like even take your Alexa, right? So like, you know, you go home and you're talking to Alexa. What if Alexa could actually display something like overlaid that was a hologram, right? Digital. So it doesn't need a screen, doesn't need any special place. So there's like lots of possibilities for this. Robotics is another fantastic place, right? And it's sort of along the lines of our best science fiction movies, right? But combining holograms, holographic displays with robotics, there's a lot of work going on there. And of course, vehicles, right? We all have seen these scenarios where you get in a vehicle that's like autonomous or semi-autonomous, all of a sudden you have all this time, right? And so holograms are looked at as entertainment. As a designer, part of the book that I shift into now is actually doing the work. As a designer, we often overthink. I think it's fair to say, like, designers overthink. I'm done with that, right? I'm done with design process. Can't stand it. Hate most processes, to tell you the truth. So I'm like, how do I get from A to B as fast as I can? And that's how I typically work. We have a very quick pace in the garage. And so this is what we use. We call a fast design. I'm sure you do very similar things. But when you're envisioning, the idea is not to overthink your envisioning. It's just like, just keep cranking stuff out. It could be bad. It could be good. It doesn't matter. Like, just keep going fast. Just keep going fast. When you frame something, the next step of envisioning after like you decide that you are actually going to go fast is you have to figure out what to leave out, right? Like, what is not important? It's easy to say, well, let's figure out what's important. That's how every meeting starts. Let's figure out what's important about this release. It's actually more important to figure out what you don't care about and just ignore it. And that will help you go faster, I think, as far as process goes. So framing helps you get a much clearer picture of that. When you go to prototype, you actually need to be, and again, I'm just sort of summarizing like the whole bunch of pages in every one of these chapters. This is what I've learned. You have to be in the device to do great prototyping. Yes, you can make paper prototypes. Yes, you can make, you know, sketchy things. Yes, you can make, you know, like kind of, you know, I would say 3D models of things. But unless you're actually in the experience, you're not going to understand how people are gonna feel when they're in. And so I would encourage you, like as quickly as can, you know, during your envisioning of things, try to get into the headset, try to get, you know, into like using the phone for AR, it doesn't matter. Just try it. And you may have to enlist the help of a coder or somebody to help you do that. So many design, like we see a lot of design students coming out of school. A lot of them know how to code, even though they're studying design. So I think this is gonna go very quickly again. And then of course, like testing, refining, and restarting. Another really important thing that I noticed was people were tending to hang on too long instead of just giving up and starting over again. People are, I think, getting more comfortable with failing, like things that are failed, that are not working right. I'd say, you know what, embrace that. Just go for it. Doesn't work out, throw it out, start over again. It's all in that, just like you're trying to find that great breakthrough experience, and you're not going to get there if you're concerned about getting every single thing right while you're generating these ideas. And then I'm just going to do this quick demo for you. So, like again, of course, I was in Seattle in the Delta Lounge, and there was like, you know, an empty table. So what did I do? Of course, I took a picture, because that's what I always do. One thing that you can imagine with this is I'm just going to do like a super quick demo for you. We have tools now that will actually allow us to put 3D objects into pictures. So this is just like, this is PowerPoint, right? It's like your typical Microsoft PowerPoint. See this little thing up here that said 3D models? Like this is, let's see if I can get onto the Wi-Fi really quick. Even an office tool, like even a productivity tool like this. What's up? Oh, sorry about that. Oh, all right. We'll have to go back to no demos. There will be no demos today. Okay, I'll just tell you about this as we're doing this. Let's see. Are we back? Are we back? Sorry. So you never do a demo like in the middle of your demo. That's so. Okay, so what you can do, though, I can actually insert 3D objects into this. I will see if this will let me. Do this kind of drawing. You can see that? Okay, right. Okay, so you see how I'm actually like drawing over this picture? It's super simple with tools that you have access to right now to actually inject 3D objects or drawings or other photographs and just composite them really fast to illustrate your idea. That's all you're trying to do, right? You're just trying to get your idea out of your head and in front of somebody else. So very, very simple to be able to use the tools at our disposal to do this. So we talked about, so the first part of the book is a setup of like you know, what are these holograms and why do we care? The next part of the book is like, here are the things you need to think about when you're starting to work. And then the last part of the book is me just showing examples of what I've done in my explorations and trying to learn about this. So I did a series called Holoscenes. And so Holoscenes was really all about starting from these places. But you notice that when I take these pictures, they feel like there should be people there, right? So that's why I discovered, too, is empty spaces where there's chairs or tables or something, they feel like there needs to be people. So if you ever create something without people in it, you've done something wrong, just fundamentally, right? There's never, nothing worth, you know, doing is devoid of people, right? So especially as designers, we have to make sure that we're always injecting people back in the scene. For me, it's very easy to think about, look, I was looking at this hotel, like, you know, across the street, and I was like, I wonder how much that, like, corner room was for the night. And we can do this with our phones, and we can do this with our laptops, but why can't we just directly, right, like, directly look at things and interact with them? So that's where my envisioning took me in this particular series, this Holocene series. I also did another series where I took data. Remember, I was talking about data. I took census data for New York City, and I was, like, playing around with it in a three-dimensional program that we put out for doing DataViz through the garage called Sandance. And as I was playing around with this, this sort of looked like skyscrapers to me. And I thought to myself, wow, this would be a really great project to actually put at room scale. Remember, we talked about using the scale to your advantage. So, like, putting holograms that were, you know, they were not as big as skyscrapers, but they were huge in the space I was in. That was a great experiment for me. And the thing that I got to next, which is the most important, is when you do things, if they're devoid of atmosphere, if they're devoid of lighting and feel and, you know, other ambient, you know, noise, like, sound is super important to these things. They just feel cold. We're, like, back to the empty space feeling. So whenever you get a chance to inject, so it's hard to see in this, but if you look at my work online, you can see there's always something atmospheric, some type of lighting that's bringing some emotion to these things, right? Because holograms, like anything else that we make, can't just be objects because they'll be completely boring, right? And we need them to be magic. We need them to be better than that. The last thing I did was explore art. So, you know, every painting, every photograph, every piece of sculpture, they all have backstories, right? The artist was thinking of something in particular when they were doing it. And so the easiest thing for me to do is take some of my sister Sharon's artwork. Right? She's a artist in New York City, and she actually paints onto maps. And just imagining being able to explode that, right? Because she started with a map, she sketched on it, she painted over the top of it, and then sort of bringing that back together, right? So just imagine how many pieces of artwork, music, film, that you could take apart because now we have this, like, holographic palette to work with, right? Where you can actually see things in space that don't interfere, they could interfere with the structure of things, but it opens up all kinds of possibilities. One of the most interesting things for me, the reason that I like to use mixed reality is that it helps me to see the invisible. That was, like, one of the key insights for me was this is all about the invisible for me. It's like other people, it's like making dinosaurs or, like, you know, putting you in the middle of some experience. For me, it was like I wanted to see inside and behind and into things and people and places and animals. Like, there's so many things that we can explore, like, together that we should really spend more time thinking about that. And finally, when you go through this whole process and you stop and think, you know, like, if you're trying to reflect and you give yourself enough time to think about it, the thing that stood out to me was we were at the very beginning. Remember I showed you the picture of the original cell phone? It's like, it would be ridiculous to see somebody, right, like, talking on a cell phone like that. We were at the very, very, very beginning of this cycle, right? These, like, headsets and these phones and these things that we have right now, they are primitive compared to what we're going to have in 5 years. And so because we're at the very beginning, it's our responsibility as designers and marketers and executives and people driving things forward to make sure that we're completely inclusive in designing both the technology and the experiences. So Microsoft and others have been really pushing to try to get designers and engineers and other people to try to be more inclusive in their thinking, right? About, and inclusive design means we're designing for everybody, right? So, and it's kind of, you know, another insight that like really dawned on me the other day was we talk about being situationally impaired, right? So if you walk out into the bright sunlight and you can't see and you're trying to use your phone, it's a very difficult experience. If you're like holding grocery bags and you're trying to open a door, you're situationally impaired. Just imagine people that have that to deal with all the time. As designers, if we actually thought about that at the beginning, instead of trying to bolt things on at the end or try to, you know, move things around, we would be so much better off. And so I think it's our responsibility as an industry, as individuals, to try to do inclusive design in this new space, which is in its infancy from the very beginning. So it's something that I would love for you to think about. There was an afterword for the book that didn't get in, but the afterword was really about a reflection on family. And kind of at the end of the day, you know, we are all like very busy and we're doing super exciting things. You know, we like to have a lot of different experiences, but for many of us, there's always that moment where you see the future of something, right? And you recognize it completely. And for me, when you look at kids using this technology and you look at how, like what they want and what they're trying to do and what they ignore and what they're thinking and feeling, you see the future of this. So I would also encourage you, if you want to envision in the space, if you want to work with holograms, go watch kids do this because you'll see exactly where it's going to end up. So thanks for sitting through that. Sorry, like you didn't get to see a lot of the like what's in the book because you can read what's in the book. I was trying to share some things that maybe you wouldn't find right away. You can always find me online. I would be happy to stay for a bit and answer questions if you guys have any questions. I'd be happy to demo stuff. We can chat about whatever you want. Are there some mics that people can use? Is that important? And you're going to ask, why didn't I bring a hologram with me, right? I do have one.
Hi. My name is Jeff Chow. I work for a company called Digital Domain, and we make holograms for Tupac.
Can I come and work for you?
Sure. My question is, we have this technology. It's rudimentary. It's very expensive.
Yeah.
Takes a long time to set up.
Yes,
but
it
we
does.
Can make a photoreal hologram. Mm-hmm. And I'm reading about laser holography, and I'm sure you're doing research on it.
Yeah.
When do you think is the curve from when today, which is primitive, to laser?
Yeah, I think.
What's your thoughts on that?
So being like a student, I guess, or admirer of Ray Kurzweil's projections, I think 5 years is actually a reasonable projection because we are in the accelerating part of the curve right now, and so things are going to go much faster than anybody really thinks.
Wow.
So at least to the point where people can start building experiences with them. Right. So So call me Digital Domain. Right.
Hi, I'm really interested in your idea that you say that holograms are very emotional. I work in film. I'm very interested in how hologram can play a part in documentaries particularly. Where do you see the potential for that?
Sorry, I didn't hear the last part.
The potential for how holograms can be used in documentary filmmaking.
Oh, that's a great question. So where would holograms be used in documentary filmmaking? I think just like everybody else, people are trying to figure out how can other people besides me experience them, right? Because it's easy for a single person, like you can build a holographic experience and I can see it, maybe a few other people can share it. The big breakthrough will come when we're able to actually get the holograms out of the single person's optics, right, and into the space. Like documentaries, it you can do it now. People have done some great examples in VR of using, you know, digital objects, you know, so that you sort of feel like in small spaces, right? You almost feel like you need to, crouch down. So being transported into a virtual world lends itself a bit more than mixed reality, because mixed reality is I'm here in this object or like whatever kinds of objects are interacting with me. Documentaries, for me, seem to like teleport me somewhere else, right? They sort of take me somewhere, or they bring something to me that I've never seen before. And I think until holograms are able to be seen with a very wide field of view. Like, so virtual reality, it looks expansive compared to mixed reality today, which is sort of very fixed, like a small viewport. And it seems like documentaries, you don't want to box them in like that, right? Like they want to be a full experience. So maybe it's going to be a little bit until we figure out. And I see a lot of college kids and I ask them, how would you use this? Because they're filmmakers in some cases. It's like, how would you use this technology? And they don't know yet. But they're going to figure it out. What was your thought? Can I ask? Like, what was your first thought as a documentary? So you're a documentary maker? Yeah. So what's your first thought about using it?
So, I mean, it's interesting because there's been lots of talk and I've had conversations with various people, and the one thing they are very excited about is if you happen to be working in wildlife documentaries, because if you are able to be transported to that place, so you're actually in the jungle, or you're actually on a safari somewhere, or you might be in the middle of a desert somewhere, I think that would totally significantly change what your audience is experiencing in a far more... can't think of the word, but in every single way. But yeah, I'm very intrigued because I still don't know how that will pan out other documentaries.
One thing that you just mentioned that is interesting to note. So for mixed reality, just because of the medium, right, the way that the medium plays out, you would have to take like a tiger, for example, and you would have to take it out of its environment and put it into your environment. So it's like a, you know, it's like a magician's trick, right? It's like, oh, like, look, there's a tiger walking around in my living room. As opposed to virtual reality where you're actually in the jungle, it's kind of creepy, you're hearing noises that you don't normally hear, like you're a little scared because you're immersed, completely immersed. Mixed reality with holograms, things are out of place sometimes. And so that's something that we have to figure out. Mm. It's like, how do we use that to our best advantage? People are starting to figure it out, but I don't have a great answer. Maybe you'll figure it out.
Well, we'll see.
Well, write me. First of all, can I just say thank you very much for staying. I really do appreciate it. Like, I'm happy to stay and chat. This is all like very interesting to me. You got the super abbreviated version. The book is much better.
Okay. Hi. Nice to meet you. You talk about the holograms are like light in space. You know, that's what defines a hologram. I had that experience when I first tried the THC vibes, you know, because you are inside this world and you can actually see stuff made by light, you know.
Right.
Are you aware of any device or something with no glasses or nothing on your head that can actually produce that kind of images? I know about, maybe you know about Chef Hans, that kind of system you can project light on dust or stuff like that, but I mean something like really, really, you can create light in the space.
Yeah, there are companies, good question, there are companies that have projection systems that are sort of encased boxes and other shapes where you can completely like look around the hologram and you can see it from all different angles.
Yeah.
It's encased.
Yeah.
Right, it's not free floating in the air. So if that's what you're
always ends with a screen or sort of screen.
Yeah.
Is there anything else?
I mean, there are holograms that are projected into the air.
Like Princess Leia's kind of hologram.
That technology, like you can bet that there's many, many, many people trying to figure out how to actually cross the light, right, so that you get a stable enough image that it's convincing. Like you can do it. But I think it's the convincing part, right, that we haven't quite got to yet.
Okay.
Because when you're using other methods, like other optics, it's actually quite convincing. It's like objects look lit and solid, and they have texture. And when it's just in the light, it's like sometimes something that's not as bad as like Princess Leia hologram, but not as convincing.
Kind of more. Thank you.
Yeah. No, thank you.
Can you speak to how you've dealt with the challenges of limited field of view?
Yeah, not well.
Well, you know, a lot of the design that you've shown in the envisioning is beautiful in concept. But in the work we've done, we've found that the illusion is destroyed by the limited field of view.
Yeah, you have to use your imagination. I mean, you know very well. The scene is all there. It's just that you can't see it all with the optics, some of the optics that we have now. To tell you the truth, sometimes if I'm really bummed about that, I'll actually do it in VR. Because I want the expansiveness of it. It kind of wrecks the, you know, what I'm going for, because I would rather have the real world. You know, just like any other piece of technology, the field of views will get better, like for many different types of headsets and gear.
Right. I guess what I'm getting at the moment is, with the limited hardware we have available today, creating compelling experiences in mixed reality is beyond creating the scene.
Yeah.
It has to be the scene as you can experience it here.
Right. Interesting. So I'm gonna give you like a counter argument, because I started doing that. When I first started doing this type of design work, everything was tabletop and it was small and it was all in the field of view. And that bummed me out. I was like, you know what? That's not what this is for. And so I started to go room scale and go bigger, and I turned my head and I deal with the limited field of view, knowing that we're going to get to the better ones before too long. And like I said, if it's just bumming me out, then I go to mixed reality so I can actually get the full effect.
Right.
But there's no good answers today. Hopefully very soon there will be. Please don't give up. Because I think as a medium, it's actually going to be the more dominant medium in the long run. Meaning that you know, we will experience whatever these digital things in our own world more than we will be completely immersed and more than we'll be holding up something to look through, right? Like maybe wearing glasses, I don't know, we'll see. It's very messy, right, between AR and MR right now. It's like what's yeah. what? And especially when you're talking about glasses as opposed to like looking through something. But please don't give up.
Absolutely.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Oh, it's just one sec.
She walked up to the microphone.
Come
on, get in line. I've been thinking a lot about autonomous vehicles and taking back the commute, mm-hmm. right? Like yeah. now that we're inside the car, mm-hmm. we no longer have to drive, really taking advantage of that space and that time again. And I think there's just so much potential in mixed use and AR mm-hmm. and thinking about the fact that you're surrounded by six screens, essentially, right? Mm-hmm. Maybe even seven with your right. moonroof and mm-hmm. taking advantage of all of that. And I've been thinking a lot about starting to create, I'm a user interface designer, not on cars yet. If anybody's hiring for that position, let me know. But thinking about activating that space, and I came here today because one of the things that I keep thinking about is it's really easy to create that single perspective
right.
when you're watching something out the window and then it's mm-hmm. driving by you and you're panning with it and it's like got its Yelp review on the side right. of the building, right? And you're looking past it. It's really easy to do that from one pair of eyes, but then when you've got two people or a family in the car, how can that all track simultaneously?
Right.
And I thought maybe hologram, that the hologram type technology, which is more of a shared
yeah.
augmented experience, would maybe have some secrets in that. Mm-hmm. How are you guys solving for those sorts of problems and thinking about them and that field of view? And there's just so much potential inside yeah. the vehicle. I geek out about it. I was just wondering where you're at.
It's a great question, great design problem. So a couple of things to think about. Number one, there are people working on a large system to sort of keep track of permanence. So like right now with HoloLens and other technologies, there's an idea of permanence. Like if you put something somewhere, it will stay there forever. Okay. So imagine that the world was now mapped. So we knew where things existed in the world. So now as you were driving down the street and you were wearing, you know, some kind of device or you had something or your screens in the car, and when you were looking on a particular vector, you're like looking out the window, the device could figure out what you're looking at and render it from the right perspective. Now it's like you're moving, like complicates things, it's like super hard math, right? But you can imagine that that's a solvable problem eventually. The thing that's, and we also have shared perspective now. So we could have three or four or however many people in the same space, you know, like all wearing either headsets or HoloLenses or whatever, and they can all be looking at the same thing from different angles, right? Solve problem. That's in like, you know, use the cloud, right? Like figure out where you are. So that part you can figure out. The part that I think is difficult is what you said about being in a moving vehicle because of the speed and the like latency issues and so like challenging. There's lots of smart people in the world, I'm sure. Like there was this really cool thing that you could look up on the web where somebody took a school bus, right? And it was like something Mars or like something Moon, and they put school kids in a yellow school bus that was specially outfitted. They blacked out the windows, and they took them, like they drove them around Mars, right? Like, you know what I'm talking about? It was amazing. That's a great project to look up and cool. see what was the tech that they used for that. Because none of the kids had headsets on, but it was like they were transported, right?
They didn't. They just had screens, and they just played it. It wasn't overlaid on something outside of the car. Okay.
Yeah, it was like one of the greatest magician's tricks ever. It was fantastic.
It's got to come soon. I've got to figure it out.
Yeah, it's like maybe there's some hints there for you. Like you guys have no place to be, like no drinking, no barbecue, no like what's going on? I'm happy to stay as long as you want. Like if you want to chat.
So I was thinking back to the example that you gave about when you were reading Ready Player One and you were missing that visual for... Yeah.
Did you see that there's a Ready Player One like thing over on the street over there?
I haven't been there yet.
Yeah? They made the outside look like stacked trailers, right?
Oh,
on the outside
I'll go
of
check
the building.
It out right after this.
Yeah, it's like right around the building here somewhere.
Okay. So it got me thinking about... one of the mediums that I'm really interested in is the graphic novel, and there has been an integration of AR technology and graphic
right.
novel, but you need
right.
your mobile device
right.
to look at the frame
okay.
itself.
Okay, I got a request.
How do you think...
I got a request for you. You love graphic novels,
yes.
right? Okay, please don't like open the book and have something pop out of it?
No.
Okay.
No.
Like, but been there, done that.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to ask you about, because there has to be kind of like an intermediary medium where it stops being a graphic novel and becomes kind of like an animated film, per se. Yeah. So where does that medium lie, or will hologram destroy a previous medium in emergence of a new one, you know, the way silent films were kind of sidelined with more integration of sound technology?
Well, that would be good for book sales if that happened. But no, I don't think it's going to be that dramatic. I think it's going to be an additive technology at first and an additive medium, and then it will become just sort of like so commonplace that it'll be the interface to your toaster. It'll be the interface to your, like, you know, when you're in a car, right? It's like projected holograms will just be like integrated into things. So I don't view it as like it's like a be-all end-all new medium in that way, although it has lots of potential for that. But what I do know is it's wrong-headed to keep trying to keep content inside of things.
Yeah.
Like when you try to encapsulate any kind of content, it's like that's not satisfying. When you figure out how to free the content and let it be in its own space, now you're onto something. That's what I was saying. Like, so what if you could design your next graphic novel totally out in the open, right? So it was not in pages, but it was like you don't have to be in a 3D environment, but there's so much creative space there to play around with, right? Maybe it's like semi 3D or like goes from one to another. I mean, there's lots to explore.
Like the holograms on your Visa cards.
But just don't put it in a frame.
Right.
When you find yourself putting stuff in frames, stop and think to yourself, do I really need to put this in a frame?
Thank you.
It just bugs me. Okay, so are you guys designers? Are you like filmmakers? Are you musicians? Like, what's going on? Because I'm curious. Like, I'm just kind of curious who was interested to come to the talk. Music? Great. Fantastic. Anybody else? Excellent. Music and software. I like that. Great. Love that.
Architecture.
I have this theory that kids that are in architecture programs that know how to code and, like, you know, that are like sort of creative, when they come out of those programs now, they're going to be monsters. Like, they're just going to be able to do anything because they're learning how to think spatially in a more, I would say, thoughtful way, right? More principled way. I mean, some people are very good at thinking spatially just by themselves, and they'll do fine. But I just thought that the architecture programs are, and actually, I got invited to go talk to architecture students at UC Berkeley in a couple weeks, and I'm going to ask about this. Like, what are they learning? And if they were going to go do something, what would they do? Because I would love to see what they came up with. That's another thing I notice is a lot of college students are coding, right? They're like designing, coding. They're very fluent, going back and forth. It's like no big deal. And so hopefully they'll pick this up too. Okay, so you guys can, like, we can keep chatting. I'm happy that you can come up and talk. You can, I'd be happy to sign a book for you. If anybody shows up, like, maybe I'd even buy one for you.